Stand by. Transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to the first brand new show of 2011, and happy new year to you and yours. We are ecstatic to tell you that Vancouver Olympic sweetheart Joanie Richette, who won the bronze medal after her mother tragically passed away during the competition, joins us on the show this week. Former U.S. Marine Mike Scotti is also here to talk about his documentary Severe Clear and what it was like to be in the Middle East post 9/11. We've also got a killer remix from Stromae to get you moving. Tons to do. Let's go.
Capture your need for sound.
Well, I can't believe another year has come and gone. 2010 is now in the books, and we march full on into 2011. And on behalf of all of us here at the Kelly Alexander Show, I just wanted to take a moment to wish you all a very happy new year and best wishes for 2011. And again, on behalf of the team, we hope that you enjoy the last 2 weeks of programming as we took a look back at what happened on our show in 2010 and played some of our favorite interviews, including our chat with Mia Michaels, also Nadine Lerner of Roller Derby. She's a fun girl and an awesome listener, so we appreciate that. Also Debbie Travis, and the list goes on and on. So thank you so much for being with us over the last 12 months as we were able to get those interviews and present them to you. And now we march forward into 2011, trying to do the best that we can, again, with more interesting topics and issues. And again, cool guests and celebrities. And we've got a pretty kick butt show for you coming up, this week. But before we sort of march into that, I kind of got to get on my soapbox a little bit, and my plan is to sort of ease into 2011, but with the recent situation going on in Tucson, Arizona, with the shooting of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, I just wanted to take a moment to send out my condolences to the people that passed away in that tragedy, especially that cute little 9-year-old girl. And also to the families now that have to pick up the pieces, and, you know, to the families and friends of the ones who survived and are going through and are going to have to go through, you know, a recovery period and a time of healing. So my best thoughts and all of our thoughts here from the show to those people. And something that sort of, I guess ticked me off is the best way of putting it with regards to the whole situation. I mean, there's so many angles of looking at this Tucson, Arizona shooting, but one of the issues that I guess struck me the most in the days immediately following the situation is the fact that people decided to grandstand a little bit and make this, into some sort of a political event. And I realized that, Congresswoman Giffords was there on political reasons, when the shooting happened. But I don't believe that the shooting happened, entirely because of what she was. I think, obviously, more details are to follow with regards to what the gunman was thinking. But from all accounts, he was definitely off his rocker. So I don't think he was firing on all cylinders. And even though I guess a huge portion of why he did what he did was because of the delusions in his head with regards to political reasons, I don't think that the media, and I don't think that politicians should have taken that opportunity to start blaming one another. I know there was numerous accounts of the Democrats blaming the Republicans and the Republicans, blaming the Democrats. And I don't think this was a time for that. It was a very tragic situation. And again, I don't think the shooter, again, firing on all cylinders. And it is what it is. It's a tragic event. And this is not the time to make it into a political grandstanding event, to try to gain followers or gain supporters for, their specific parties. So I was very upset by that. And I'm sure there it wasn't just me. I'm sure if you were following the story, that was something that didn't sit well with you either. And I would just hope that when all is said and done, somebody realizes that this, is not a situation to take advantage of. And sadly, I just think with the way the world's going, something else like this is probably going to happen, in the future. I don't think that these politicians are going to be immune to violence, especially because some of the issues that they bring forth are very contentious to people, you know, in the States and even around the world, whether it was another country entirely that had a situation like this. So I think the main thing, again, is to remember that there's victims in this, the actual people who passed away, the ones that were injured, Congresswoman Gifford, and again, the families and friends that are going to have to be there to pick up the pieces. So from all of us here at the Kelly Alexander Show, our best wishes to everyone that was involved in that situation. And also a big shout out to the doctors who did such a good job trying to save the lives of those people that were affected in that shooting. So on to happier topics here on the Kelly Alexander Show. I am absolutely thrilled to bring you our first interview with Olympic bronze medalist, but gold medalist, I think in my heart, and I think in the world's heart, Joanny Rochette. I have to tell you, I try not to gush when I meet celebrities or speak with celebrities. And, you know, she's an athlete and a strong Canadian athlete, but she captured all of our hearts during the 2010 Olympics when her mother passed away during competition. And I've been wanting to speak to her for months and was just, you know, hoping beyond hope that I would actually get the opportunity to do so. And she is just such a sweetheart, and I can't wait for you to hear all that she has to say with what the year 2010 brought to her life and to her family's life. So without further ado, please get ready for the one and only Joanny Rochette.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
I am completely thrilled to introduce you to my next guest. She captured all of our hearts at the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver after managing to bring home a bronze medal in skating for Canada in the midst of a devastating personal tragedy. And she's recently been named Female Athlete of the Year from CBC Sports. Joanny Rochette, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Joanny, I have to tell you, it's a huge honor to have you on the show. And I have to ask you, going into the Olympics, you were definitely a Canadian fan favorite. But after you battled through the loss of your mother and ended up winning that bronze medal, it feels like you became a worldwide hero, an inspiration to people all over the world. Do you feel that when you were traveling from city to city?
Well, first of all, when I was competing in Vancouver, I was in my bubble because I didn't really realize what was going on outside of the village. Everyone did a pretty good job at keeping me centered and focused on my performance only. But of course, when I came back from the Olympics, I couldn't believe how many people followed me and how many people watched my performance, and everyone was telling me about it and where they were when they watched it. But yeah, when we're traveling around the world, like in Japan especially, they're very big skating fans, or in Korea or even across Canada, it's so nice to see people that supported me, and you know, I felt really blessed to have all of their support during that tough time for me at the Olympics.
And Joanny, as you look back at what you accomplished at the Olympics, you know, because it's been several months since the Olympics, are you sort of amazed that you managed to sort of, you know, stay strong, keep everything together, and then come through for yourself, your family, as well as for Canada?
Well, I had a lot of support when that happened at the Olympics, and I felt like I was on, you know, a robot on a mission, and I felt like, you know, when I went back to the ice right after learning the news, I went back to the ice maybe 6 hours after hearing my mother passed away, and I think that's what saved me, to be back into a known territory and where I feel closest to her, because she was very involved in my skating career. And we had a couple of friends from my hometown that made the trip as well to support my parents, so I was very happy that they were there to support my father during that time, and I didn't have to worry about him so much. Of course, I did worry, but I knew that like some people were taking care of him. But also, when I went back to the ice, I felt almost responsibility to entertain them because they made the trip and they were all there supporting. So I was lucky to have all that support over there.
That's amazing. And now that you've been named Female Athlete of the Year, what does that make you feel like?
Well, to be honest, I can't believe that people still support me, remember me from the Olympics, and it's a huge honor to be there, to be named Athlete of the Year. There was very big names in the round too. If I'm thinking of like Georges St. Pierre, a lot of great other athletes that were with me at the Olympics. We won actually 14 gold medals. So, I mean, to be named Athlete of the Year is a huge, huge honor.
And what have you been up to since the Olympics? Did you actually manage to take any time off and just sort of chill out for a bit and reassess what you want to do with your life?
Actually, not really, because for us in figure skating, right after the Olympics is our probably the busiest season of her career because there's so many skating shows. And that's what I did. I left for Japan and did the Canadian tour with Stars on Ice. I think my season ended in June with the shows in Korea. Then I took maybe 2 or 3 weeks off. But I was in Montreal for most of the summer, which felt good. I did a couple of TV shows, but I was off the ice for at least a month and a half, which felt nice. But I went back to the ice in September, did my first competition in October, and now I decided to focus on shows and exhibition skating for the rest of the season.
And this past year, Joanie, you've been through, you know, so much, a bunch of highs, a bunch of lows. What have you learned about yourself through all of these ups and downs?
But you never know how strong you can be until something like that happens. I had a friend whom it happened to her. She lost her mother, and the next day she was back on the ice. And I didn't believe how she could do it. And I was always thinking, if that was me, I could never do it. But when it happens, when you have to do it, you can find the strength inside yourself, and you can find that courage to save your life. And for me, that was to compete at the Olympics, because I had been working my whole life, right? I've been skating for more than 20 years. So Olympics come around once every 4 years. So it was a very tough decision to take. But at the same time, I knew that if I didn't skate in Vancouver, I would regret it sooner or later.
And Joanie, when you were actually standing, well, actually, I have two questions. When you finished your final skate for the Olympics, what did it feel like when you were standing there and on the ice and the crowd was going crazy? What do you remember what you felt?
Oh, Vancouver for me is still a little bit of a blur. It's good I have images to remember and people to remind me of it. But I just remember when I was standing on the podium when I got my medal, I thought of the little girl when I was younger doing drawings of me on an Olympic podium, and probably my teacher at school were sick of seeing that. But I remember also practicing my jumps, waiting for the school bus when I was 5 or 6. And yeah, I just remember it being my childhood dream and finally it being true, because sometimes when you're so absorbed and you're training for so many years to get there, you kind of forget why you wanted to do it in the first place. And to me, when I got my medal, that's the first thing I could think about.
I'm so glad that you brought up when you were a little girl, because that was a question that I had for you as well. Right now, you have a ton of little girls who want to be just like you, and they're probably standing outside their bus stops, you know, right now, doing little twirls and pretending that they're you. What advice do you have to these little ladies who dream of going to the Olympics and becoming, you know, their generation's Joanie Richet?
Well, it takes a lot of passion and hard work, but even though I was dreaming of the Olympics when I was younger, I don't think I believed it until I was maybe 15 or 16 years old, when I was on the national team in the senior category. But all I would say is it takes passion and not counting the hours you put in working on the ice.
And a question I have for you as well, because I know that a lot of hockey players and stuff sort of talk about how important their parents are to them as they have to train, you know, and go to the rink, you know, all the time. And I know that it's probably the same for figure skaters and anyone else who has Olympic dreams. What do you feel towards your family in the fact that they, you know, helped you get where you are?
Well, a big, big part of my success comes from my family. It belongs to them, because ever since I'm young, my father just kept working hours to bring money to sponsor my skating career. He would always want me to have the best skate I could, or the best coaches. And my mom would take me from school to the rink every day, be my taxi. They would bring me to Montreal to find more, to find extra ice time. They were always there to support me when times were harder, and there to cheer for me when I was succeeding. It was a big family adventure, I would say, in my whole career. And it's not only the end result that matters, but also all the memories that come with it when I look back at my career and my whole life. I mean, I've been skating, so there's a lot of memories related to it.
And do you think, Joanie, because I think the answer is probably going to be yes, but with regards to your skating career, and again, your mom being the taxi driver and the cheerleader, and your dad trying to do his best to make sure that you could have the best of what you needed to do to accomplish your goals, do you think skating brought you and your family closer together, and it's like the glue that just solidified? Because, you know, a lot of girls, you know, especially teenage girls, if they're not into sports, they go off and do other things, and they're not really as tight with their family. Do you think skating and sport brought that to your family?
Well, yes and no. Yes, of course, because we knew each other very well, and we've been through a lot together. But at the same time, I left home when I was 12 or 13 years old to be able to get more hours for skating. So it was hard on my family. I was an only child, and living home for me was one of the toughest thing I did. But I knew it was to achieve my goal, and I had a dream, so I had to do it. I was traveling a lot too, so of course I kind of missed out a little bit on family stuff sometimes, but my mom was always a phone call away, and we're always very close, and she was always, you know, giving me advice, her advice on my skating, and she was a tough critique, but that's what made me the skater that I am today. But not only for skating, she wanted me to have a complete life as well, keep going to school and be happy no matter what I do, and they did a very good job at supporting me and helping me do what I want to do in life.
Joining us on the show is Canadian Olympic medalist and figure skating superstar Joanie Rochette. And Joanie, you just spoke a little briefly about school. Is that something that you're doing now, or do you want to further your education?
Yes, I'm actually finishing my CEGEP at Henri Grasset right now. I have one more class to be done, so I'm really excited to finally finish it. I'm going to be 25 soon, so it took a long time, but at least I finished it, and I'm really proud of that.
That's amazing. And then do you know what you want to do after skating? Do you always want to have a hand in skating?
Probably yes, because skating is my passion. But at the same time, I want to do something else. I don't know yet what I want to do. I wanted to do more health sciences. That's what I did in CEGEP, but I don't know what the future holds. I mean, I wanted to do university for sure, but we'll see. I have a few years to decide. I'm going to do some skating shows for a few years, then hopefully go back to school and maybe have a family too.
That's amazing. And Joanie, I have to ask you, I know that, you know, as an athlete, you have to take things sort of one step as at a time. And I actually recently spoke with Carolyn Ouellette, and I asked her the same question. So I'm going to ask you, do you want to be in Russia in 2014?
That's a tough question to answer. I don't know yet. It will depend. I mean, in figure skating, usually in the ladies event, the girls are maybe between 18 and 23, 24 years old. So I don't know if I could do it and if it will be still in me, but I'm still keeping active. And of course, I just competed in Japan, and I know I love competition, but we'll see. Like, 4 years is a long way to go.
Okay. And before I let you go, Joanie, I have to ask you just a couple of quick questions, because I think a lot of people and your fans want to get to know you a little bit better, especially your English fans who, you know, maybe don't see as much press about you in the English press outside of Montreal. So I call these Joanie fast fact questions. Okay. They're fun. So first of all, I have to ask you, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream?
Cookie dough.
Nice. Who is your favorite singer or band?
The Beatles.
Good for you. That's awesome. Do you like, are you a fan of Lady Gaga?
Yeah, I love what she does too.
That's good. And do you have a favorite movie?
Gattaca.
Oh, wow. Look at that. That's different. Are you a morning person or a night owl?
Oh, night for sure.
And if you are to go out to a restaurant, what's your favorite type of food to go eat? Italian, Mexican?
French food.
French food, good for you. And
Montreal, there's so many.
There are so many in Montreal. And if a movie was made about your life, what actress would you like to play you in that movie?
Uma Thurman.
Good for you. That's awesome. Joanie Rochette, thank you so much for spending time with us on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Canadian Olympic medalist and figure skating superstar Joanie Rochette. Please check her out, www.joanierochette.ca.
And I could feel my wings riding the wind. Yeah. I see the finish line just up ahead now. And I can feel the rising deep within. And that's the sign of a victory.
Back in December, we were very fortunate to have an amazing guest on our show speaking about putting things into perspective over the holiday season and not getting so caught up in your own lives, but thinking about what some of the men and women are doing, both in the Canadian and the U.S. military for us overseas. And again, no matter where you are in the world, if you have a military and people are sacrificing their lives to go out and sort of take care of your own country, it's a very important thing and something to think of. And so we are very grateful to have Mike Scotti join us again on the Kelly Alexander Show to talk about some more of his experiences when he was a Marine over in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mike, thank you for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Mike, so when we talked to you last time, you gave us a bit of a perspective about how you got into being a Marine and that you were actually sent over to or overseas prior to September 11th, at least by a month or so. I just wanted to pick up and sort of ask you, you know, when you were over there and what did you know immediately when September 11th happened that your life was going to change and just how you were operating as a part of a unit in the Marines that it was going to change for you over there?
Sure. You know, I had been a Marine since 1995 when I enlisted in the reserves while I was still in college. And, you know, 4 years later, I went to boot camp a second time and became a lieutenant and on active duty. You know, so you wake up every day and put on the uniform. And we had been part of what's called the Marine Expeditionary Unit, which is a 2,000-man fighting force. It's totally self-contained on Navy ships. And you basically sail around the world and hit various ports, and you're training with local militaries, and you're kind of the quick reaction force for the country. So we just happened to be in Darwin, Australia. We just completed 4 days of live fire training with the Australian military, kind of out in the outback in the wilderness, and we had one night of liberty, and liberty is basically a night off. So you go back to the ships, you put on your civilian clothes, and you kind of you know, 2,000 crazy drunken Marines and sailors kind of take over the town. And I was actually in a casino playing their version of craps when the, you know, on the television, the casino kind of flipped to the live news channel. And one of the Marines said, "Hey, sir," because I grew up in New Jersey, in the U.S., which is right next door to New York City. And they said, "Hey, sir, you know, the World Trade Center is on fire." And we're watching this live, and, you know, obviously we saw the second plane hit the other tower, and all of our jaws basically dropped. And there's that moment where I'm thinking about my own family and people that I know who work in downtown Manhattan. And then there's kind of the next realization after the initial shock is, were the Marines that are going to go in? We had no idea where we were going, but we knew that we would retaliate, the U.S. would retaliate some way, and we were the guys that were going to go do it. So immediately we realized that everything had changed, and I'll never forget the cab ride. You know, 5 minutes after, maybe 20 minutes after the planes hit, sailors and military police with bullhorns were walking through the streets of Darwin and through the casino and everything and the bars, basically screaming through the bullhorns that all Marines and sailors need to get back to the ship. And within 4 hours, we were gone. But in that cab ride that I shared with two other Marines back to the boat, we're basically thinking, you know, this is it. We're going somewhere, probably the Middle East, and, you know, who knows what lie ahead of us. So it was definitely just because I'd been in the peacetime military for, you know, 6 years at that point, and everything changed.
When, you know, sort of, I guess, post 9/11, you know, in the first weeks and months after it all happened and everyone was still sort of adjusting, what was going on with you guys over there? Were you already sort of full on having ideas about who you needed to sort of be going after and stuff like that?
You know, on a tactical level, we did and we didn't, if that makes sense. I mean, we knew our original objective was to seize an airfield out in the middle of southern Afghanistan so that we could bring in follow on U.S. forces and build more of a military presence in that country. And at that time, you know, we were the Northern Alliance, which was a loose kind of coalition of tribes, was fighting kind of on our side directly against the Taliban. So, you know, were the guys that we were killing, were they the guys that were, you know, planning these terrorist acts? No. Were they bad guys? Absolutely. Which is interesting because, for me, having both served in both Iraq and Afghanistan, it was much more clear-cut, at least in my mind, and that we, you know, who we were fighting were the ones that we needed to be fighting. And I think when we went into Iraq, it kind of got a little bit more muddy, a little more fuzzy, and you start wondering, okay, now you got guys from Syria and other countries that are fighting us, that are coming to that country to fight us, and you got Iraqis picking up arms because there's somebody, you know, invading their country. And it's kind of a weird feeling when you're, you know, in a uniform and you're there to do a job and you don't know who to trust. And it just can be very difficult to kind of sort out in your head. You just kind of stay focused.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is a former U.S. Marine, Mike Scotti. He's now an author and also a media personality. And Mike, I wanted to ask you, I guess, where the idea, and I don't even know if you knew at the time when you were taking the footage of yourself overseas in the Middle East. Can you please explain to us the idea behind your documentary, Severe Clear, and sort of how that came together and the fact that you just were documenting everything that was going on and that sort of how that lended itself to become your documentary?
Sure. So my specific job in the military was that of what's called the forward observer. So I was an artillery forward observer in an infantry battalion. I'm basically up on the front lines, you know, with the infantry unit, with a radio and a set of binoculars and maps. And when we would take, you know, enemy fire, it was my job to pick up the radio, figure out where I wanted the artillery shells and mortars and rockets from the helicopters and bombs from the jets to land in order to stop the enemy from shooting at us. So I was kind of tethered to my vehicle, which had a high-powered radio in it, so I didn't really have to be running around the battlefield. I wasn't in charge of, you know, 60 Marines or 40 Marines as a platoon commander. I really had a very specific job. It was more of a technician on the battlefield. What that allowed me to do was swap out my binoculars for a video camera, a little mini DV, you know, consumer brand digital video camera, and I could do my job just as well while I was videotaping using the video camera versus the binoculars. So it didn't ever get in the way, and I was a professional Marine. You know, I got out as a captain. I wasn't going to do something that was kind of negligent. And you'll see in the film there's actually a couple of times where my bosses, my commanding officers, are asking me if I can see anything. because the zoom on the video camera was actually more powerful than the zoom on the binoculars. So I had originally, I grew up kind of reading first-person narratives about World War I and World War II and the Korean War and Vietnam. And I was always interested, I never cared about the politics, I was always interested in what it was like, you know, in that foxhole in the Pacific for a young Marine, or what it was like in the trenches in France, you know, for a young soldier. And I decided that I was going to write my own story once I rotated back to the States, felt it was worthy because, you know, I had come from New Jersey. I you know, was, you know, very personally connected to the events on 9/11, and I fought both Iraq and Afghanistan. So really the video was just going to be my notes. It was going to be a video journal that was meant maybe, you know, not really for public consumption. I could show my family and my friends, and I was going to use that as notes for my book, because it's a lot easier to film 30 seconds of something than it is to, you know, it brings you right back to the moment. So through kind of happenstance, I ended up meeting a production company in New York City, and they saw the footage and were just like, you know, this is not a book. He's like, this is a movie. And it was really the director, Christian Fraga from Cirque Productions, who had the original vision and saw all the footage and said, yeah, there's enough here to make a film, and it's going to be a very unique film. And that's how it kind of came all about.
I guess, Mike, my question is about how many hours do you feel that you have? Like, how many hours of footage did you have? And also, because I know that you narrate through Severe Clear for all of us that are watching, was it difficult to do that, to take yourself back to those moments?
I came back with about 22 hours, and there was actually, I'd been a second tour Marine, so, you know, in Afghanistan, I was one of the junior officers in the battalion. By the time we got to Iraq, I was still a junior officer, but I was more senior. I was a first lieutenant, and there were second lieutenants who had showed up kind of in the year between Iraq and Afghanistan, or Afghanistan and Iraq, and I told those guys, I said, hey, go get a video camera because you're going to want to videotape this because there's nothing like it. It'll be your most cherished possession. And as for observers, you know, they were doing the same job that I was. So we actually got hold of some of their footage for additional footage in the film. And you'll see at the credits at the end, we credit, you know, there's three other Marines whose footage we actually ended up using all for my battalion. And it was funny to see that we all filmed the same thing. Like there was something, you know, I passed, you know, 20 minutes before their company did. There's just funny how things kind of popped out as interesting and worthy of videotaping. So, you know, as far as making the film, and this is something that the book is really about coming home from the war, and it picks up where the film leaves off, because it's a whole other battle that you have to fight, is reassimilating yourself in this civilian society. And creating this film pretty much saved, you know, my life, saved me from potentially, you know, jumping off a bridge somewhere. You know, in 2004, when I was kind of at my darkest time after I first got back, and having friends that were being killed and carrying the coffins of buddies and you know, and you're alone. You're going through it alone because I was a civilian and I was living in Manhattan. And so really editing together this footage, you know, with the editors and going and writing the voiceovers and going through all my journals and just getting all that out and watching all the footage over and over again was very cathartic for me. It was very, very, very cathartic. And it was almost like a purge of getting all the demons out. And after a while, if you've seen it 75 times, you just kind of accept it. So it's almost like desensitizing yourself to it.
Do you think your film, Mike, is helpful to other Marines or other military that are coming back that maybe need to go through that sort of, I guess, decompression, if you will?
Absolutely. And I've had, you know, hundreds of people reach out, if not close to probably 1,000 by this point, family members of people, veterans who had fought in combat, mothers and wives and children, veterans from the Korean War, veterans from Vietnam, basically saying that this film helps to create a shared experience between those who have served in combat and those who have not. And when it's your loved ones that you're isolating when you come home because you are, you know, it doesn't even need to be post-traumatic stress disorder. It can just be post-traumatic stress. And, you know, if you're alienating your loved ones because you're angry and you're feeling isolated or you're feeling, you know, natural feelings that, you know, that naturally occur in the human brain after you've been through something like that, showing that to your family, even though it's not specifically your story, a lot of the stories are very, very similar. And, you know, when we premiered at South by Southwest, one of the Marines that was in my vehicle was there. I didn't even know he was going to be there. And he was there with his family, and his mother came up to us and thanked us for making the film. And it was has happened time and time again. And you can see the sparkle in their eyes because it's like now their loved ones understand the horrors of what it's like to serve in war.
With regards to, again, civilians that are watching your film, is that what you wish the most for them to take away from it, is that they have some inkling as to what you and other men and women have gone through over there?
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted. That's why I wanted to make the film, was to have the audience experience as well, you know, as close to reality as possible of what it's like to serve in war.
And there's so many questions that just popped to my mind as you're speaking, Mike. But one, I think a lot of us over here that are civilians don't understand. And I'm sure that you guys in the military, the men and women, understand that we can understand because we're not a part of it. But I think one of the things we don't understand is just how much you guys have to sacrifice to be over there. So can you sort of speak to that, Mike, what it was like for you to be so far from home for all those months?
Yeah, I mean, it's a sacrifice that you willingly take when you join, and, you know, it's an all-volunteer force, and, you know, so it's, you know what you're getting yourself into, but, you know, it's hard to be away from home for that long. I consider myself lucky because I don't have any kids, and, you know, I'm not married, and so I noticed the emotional load was much more heavy on those who had young children, and you know, one of my fellow Marines, you know, was kind of shook up one day when he said, you know, one of my kids just asked my wife if daddy lives in the phone. And, you know, it's tough, and you're missing years. I mean, I have friends that have been on 6 combat deployments, 6, you know, since this whole thing started. And I couldn't imagine going home to my wife after going through what, you know, what the reality of war is, you know, especially multiple times, and having, you know, young children running around, and just, it's a whole nother dynamic that I think a lot of people don't really think about. And you know, there's a saying in the Marine Corps that the hardest job in the Marine Corps is a Marine Corps wife, and, you know, or husband, you know, for the female Marines that are out there. And, you know, it's a different aspect, and it's very, very difficult.
Can you explain to us, Mike, and it's a difficult question for me to ask, and forgive me for asking it, but I think a lot of us over here want to understand, you know, when you do lose a buddy over there, how are you mentally and physically capable to sort of go on and continue your duty? What, like, even in that day, it just seems like, you know, it just seems almost the biggest mountain to climb to continue doing what you need to do for your safety, as well as, again, for us over here in the States and Canada. How do you go through the day when you've just lost, you know, someone in your unit?
There's you know, there's a couple of thoughts that come to mind. The first is that you immediately just have to swallow it down. You have to emotionally shut off and not allow yourself to break down, because, you know, you have to finish the day. You have to continue fighting. You have very tactical level, you know, immediate actions to take, you know, firing back. You've got radio calls to make. I mean, you need to get out of that situation, and you can't become emotional at all. And the adrenaline's pumping, and it's almost like getting dosed with radiation, I guess, to where, you know, if you're aware that you're getting dosed with radiation, you know that something bad has just happened to you, but you're not going to feel the effects until sometime later. So you're consciously aware that something very, very terrible has happened to somebody who you know, depending on how close you are to the person who is killed or injured, is going to be devastating at some time in the future. You're just not sure when. And what ends up happening is you swallow it down, you know, kind of in the immediate time frame to continue on, many times till, you know, months or years after you come back. And that's not healthy, but it's, you know, it's the reality. It is what it is. And I think one of the biggest problems that a lot of veterans face, especially the younger veterans, which is the vast majority of them, you know, 22 to 25, you know, after they kind of rotate out and do their 4 years, is realizing that vulnerability and weakness are not the same thing. You know, in battle and in the military, you know, from day one, you're taught that those two things are the same, and they are in war. If you're vulnerable or if you're weak, the enemy's going to exploit that, and they're going to kill you. They're going to sneak through your lines, and they're going to throw hand grenades into the helicopters, and they're going to shoot you in the back of the head. But when you become a civilian, you don't have to be weak, but you need to be vulnerable. And you have to open yourself up to what you saw and what you did and what happened to you over there and what happened to your friends, and realize that it was a war, and you have to face that. And that is very, very difficult to do, number one, as a former military person, number two, as someone in their 20s. And, you know, it's seeking help or seeking some sort of creative outlet or whatever it is that you need to do. And it's very, very difficult to do that, especially when you are a civilian, and even more so when you're not surrounded by any of your buddies. And there's a difference between rotating back home and still being on active duty and part of a unit and going to work every day with people that are in camouflage because you all went through it together, versus coming home and being discharged, you know, honorably and getting out and going back into civilian world. And, you know, driving through that gate for the last time on base with a whole new world staring at you and you're just lost. So that's what the book is about.
And speaking of the book, Mike, what is the title and where can people get a hold of it?
The book is called The Blue Cascade, and it's going to be published by Grand Central Publishing, and it's due to be released in 2012. Actually, we just signed the deal last week.
Okay.
And I'm in the Florida Keys writing the rest of it at this point. So I'm going to be writing it for the next 5 or 6 months in the Florida Keys and in Colorado. And then, you know, it goes to the legal department and everything. And so it's slated to be released in 2012. But it's going to be, you know, it's basically the story of one Marine coming home and being completely lost, loss of identity and just, you know, post-traumatic stress and just in total darkness and just trying to fight my way out of that.
Mike, just a couple of questions around that, because I know, you know, I've read a bunch of articles and newspapers, you know, as the war in the Middle East has continued over the years. And I guess a couple of things that I would just like to pass along to my listeners, and obviously you would be someone in the know of this. First of all, do you think there's adequate resources for the military personnel when they come home to reintegrate into society? Or do you think there needs more and more help? And then sort of B, if you can also speak to, I guess, the suicides that I keep hearing about, that there's a lot of that goes on when people come home, because again, whether they don't reach out for help or the help's not there, that seems to take place. So if you can answer those two questions.
Sure. I mean, the resources are significantly better now than they were when I got out when I got off active duty in 2003. They're both public, you know, government funded programs, and there's private like programs. Like, for instance, in the U.S. they have something called the Wounded Warrior Project, and they do fantastic work. So the resources are definitely there. If you look at, you know, your second question about the suicides in the U.S., and this is a fact and a figure from the U.S. government, from the Veterans Affairs Administration, we're having 18 suicides a day in the United States by veterans. 18 people a day are killing themselves. That is a stratospheric number. It's ridiculously high. The VA started something called the Lifeline, which is basically a hotline for people that are having suicidal thoughts. And it was founded in 2007. It had 10,000 calls. 2008, it had 60,000. 2009, it had 100,000. In the first 6 months of 2010, it had 120,000. So you're on track to do, you know, 250,000 calls. So that's an exponential growth year over year. So it's a problem. And they're calling it the silent epidemic, because along the lines of what I described before, is you just go back out in society and you move back to your home wherever, move back with your parents or try and get a job wherever. And, you know, it's a silent suffering that just happens. And the problem is, I do believe the resources are there. The problem is getting a 25-year-old who has just gone through 3 combat tours, who is now a civilian, to admit to himself or herself that they need to go get help and that the help is going to be adequate. Because I got to tell you, I would have never, I delayed getting surgery on my shoulder. I dislocated my shoulder and tore a bunch of tissue in my left shoulder. And I purposely waited until I got out of the military so that I could go to a private surgeon instead of going to the VA, because I was afraid the quality of the care just wouldn't be where I wanted it to be. And I felt exactly the same way when I first came home. I didn't want to be kind of manhandled by some government agency of people who really didn't care, in some bureaucracy, which is still many times the case, unfortunately, in the U.S. I only wanted to talk to other veterans. So it's an interesting problem. I think it's one that's going to be very difficult to fix.
And something that I've actually always wanted to ask someone in the U.S. military, and that's why I'm also glad to have you on the phone, you know, because I think for people around the world, I think the U.S. military you know, I think, like, speaking myself as a Canadian right here, you know, I'm glad to have you guys as our neighbors because I think you guys help take care of us, even though I know that, you know, we try to do what we can with our own resources. But then I also know that you guys as a U.S. military seem to get picked on as the big bad guys, you know, that you're always sort of trying to infringe on other countries. And something that I wanted to ask, because I think sometimes the U.S. military, no matter if it's the Army or the Marines or the Navy, you guys get depicted as a bunch of rednecks that just like shooting things. And I just wanted to ask you, as a former Marine,
That's true.
Okay. No, I'm just kidding. I didn't think it was, but
I'm from New Jersey. They don't have rednecks. I'm from the state that gave us Jersey Shore.
That's right. That's true. But what do you say, Mike, to people who, you know, think that? And then also, I guess my second part of the question is the gist that I get from stories that I do read is that when you become a member of the military in the U.S. for, I think, a lot of instances, you just want to serve your country. And it's not about, you know, which political party is in charge. Can you answer speak to that?
Sure. I mean, I would say the overwhelming majority is you know, of people that join, you know, are because they want to serve their country. I think second to that would probably be, you know, especially for the Army. Well, let me go back a second. People that join the U.S. Marine Corps join because they want to become Marines. You don't care about politics at all. You want to be a U.S. Marine. You want to be the best of the best, and you want to go to war and fight. That's what you want to do. You're young. You're full of testosterone. You go to the recruiter. You want to pick up a rifle, and you want to go serve in combat. You want to get your combat action ribbon. It's a young male's, you know, thought process. As far as political, I saw very, very little, you know, political motivation at all anywhere in there. But, yeah, so it's usually to you want to defend your country. Like I said before, it could be, you know, people that need money for college that are there for the GI Bill money. You know, it's very expensive to go to school these days. And really, you don't get to make the decisions anyway. You don't get to pick your wars. So it's kind of out of your hands. You know, you go where they tell you to go. And so it really becomes about accomplishing your mission and taking care of your people and getting them home alive.
And, Mike, before I let you go, I just wanted to ask you as well. You mentioned sort of earlier on in our conversation that, you know, the events of September 11th particularly struck home to you because you had people that you knew that were killed in the attacks. Can you just speak to that for a second? And then also, I guess, as a follow-up question to that, do you feel, you know, almost 10 years later that, I don't even know how to phrase it, that you know, we have done something to help avenge. I don't want to use the word avenge, but to help make up for what happened to your friends that were lost.
You know, as far as you know, September 11th, it was you know, it was friends from high school, and actually in Severe Clear, in the movie, one friend in particular, a woman by the name of Beth Quigley, who I knew from high school, she's actually in the film, and I actually carried her picture with me into Iraq, and I'd found out just before stepping on the helicopters to fly into Afghanistan that she had been killed. And so it was very personal for me. As far as us helping to make things right, I think the war, you know, in Afghanistan, we've definitely disrupted the Al-Qaeda network and taken the fight to the enemy. The Iraq war, obviously, we know there were no weapons of mass destruction there. That is, you know, that took me a long time to come to terms with, a long time. And I've come to terms with it, and you know, you can, as a veteran, you can go crazy thinking about who knew what and who lied to who and why did we go in there and all these other things, and then you realize that it was out of your control. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know who knew what, and it is what it is. I know that my unit did a good job over there. I did a good job over there. My Marines did a good job over there. So it is what it is. And, you know, like I said, it's almost better that we didn't, as an individual, you don't get to choose, okay, let's go invade this country and do this and that, because it's out of your hands. So you can just do the best that you can with the resources that you have, and you fight with a clean conscience. You don't do anything that will muddy up your honor, and you come home, you know, with a happy heart. So
Mike, your book coming out in 2012, and I know a lot of people are going to want to see Severe Clear because I know it's getting a lot of attention. Where can people get a hold of that?
The book will be out, you know, pretty much everywhere. The DVD is, you can get off the website now. It's going to be released in the U.S. nationwide in 2011. In Canada, I'm not sure when yet. Actually, that's going to take place, but it was just released in the U.K. and sold very, very well over there. And it was called This Is War over there. And that did really, really well. But, you know, you can get off severeclearthemovie.com or you can get off mikescotti.com and just link to it from there. And you can order it right off the web.
Awesome. Mike, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's Mike Scotti, former U.S. Marine, again, media personality and author. And again, check him out, www.mikescotti.com.
Bring on the
remix. Remix.
Featuring Kanye West with a Laurent Danse, the Damon Paul remix, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show. A big thank you going out to my guests this week, including the amazingly talented and one-of-a-kind Joanie Rachette. She was an inspiration to speak with. And again, I think all of us are extremely proud as to what she accomplished at the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver. Also, a big thank you going out to Mike Scotti for sharing his journey of being posted in the Middle East as a U.S. Marine, and also for his very important insight into how much help soldiers require when they do come back home from being, you know, on tour and as they need to sort of reintegrate into civilian life. It's a very difficult transition for them. We have no idea what they've gone through mentally, emotionally, and physically overseas, and they need all the help they can get. So again, check out Mike Scotty's website, www.mikescotty.com. And if you can, please do watch his documentary, Severe Clear. Make sure, by the way, also to tune into next week's show as our entertainment reporter from PopEater.com in New York City, Denise Warner, joins us to talk about the Golden Globes, the Grammys, also the upcoming Academy Awards. It's going to be quite the award show season, and we are very happy to have Denise from New York join us. So have a wonderful week. And before I go, I wanted to share with you a very important quote that came my way, and I think you'll find it very inspiring. It's from Lao Tzu. Be content with what you have. Rejoice in the way things are. When you realize there is nothing lacking, the whole world belongs to you. Have a great week. You and I will chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.